keep saying how much they want a strong woman. What they really want is a cheerleader.
I'd like someone who's physically very frail and won't stop talking.
I just want what everybody wants. I just seem to have a harder time getting it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 310 and Adams be splitting. It's your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. Coming all the way from Nuremberg by way of train to meet in my little town in Glendora is none other than the Christmas Zaddy himself, Max Film's favorite critic, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Oh, gee, I'm sorry. I have to be split 10. what's good is season 3 of Only Murders in the Building just started on Hulu, and it is already a treat because it's got 100% more Meryl Streep and Paul Rudd than previous seasons, so that alone makes it great. And also, my delightful friend Michael Cyril Creighton has made his way into not just the opening credits of the show, but the opening animation of the show. So Ooh. I'm really excited that he is really, you know, like getting the attention he deserves. As a key part of that program is the very funny cat-loving Howard. Anyway, it's off to a great start. I will no doubt not figure out who the killer is again this season, but that's okay because I'm terrible at that sort of thing.
Excellent.
Woo! Yes. Oh, now slowly in the end, as we all of us men were talking and conversing, we noticed, a woman. Why not throw her into our scientific mind hive? That is none other than the queen of the Midwest herself, Drea Clark. What's good?
If I had a nickel for every time I was thrown into a scientific mind hive with a bunch of dudes. I had my first of two summer vacations last week. Ooh. And appropriately, they are both sojourns to the Midwest. I did Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois. And it was wonderful. You know, it's like I have to go recharge the powers, all of that. Had a true delightful time. Made s'mores, did all sorts of wholesome shit. It was lovely. And I came back, as ever, looking like a leper from all of the mosquito bites. I am the most delicious human that's ever stupidly sat outside by a Centinella candle to no avail. And covered in bites. But yeah, I loved it. Had a great time. It would be so great to just be on vacation all the time. I don't know why nobody does that. That's so weird.
Like, I'm doing it all wrong.
Vacation's the shit. And I went by my old elementary school, which changed its name to Barack and Michelle Obama Elementary. Nice. So shout out St. Paul public school system. Woo woo. Woo woo.
Yes, I know. That was a real cool thote. I was real real excited to see it. You know who else I'm excited to see? Sitting across from me in front of a chalkboard, arms crossed, really keeps pushing that H-bomb thing that I'm not a fan of. It is writer, science communicator, and host of Max Fun Zone, Let's Learn Everything, Tom Lum. What's good?
What's good is obviously something very, very dark, serious, and scientific. It's Carly Rae Jepsen. I just came back from seeing her. She had a show that there was thunder and lightning, and so it got rained out. And then being the sweetest person in the world, did like a late night show in like the smallest, like 100-person venue, and then did a makeup show the next day at like 2 p.m., made it feel like it was the middle of the night. I was bopping. I was grooving. And that's what we're going to talk about today, right? Bopping and grooving and Carly Rae Jepsen?
For sure. Absolutely.
That's why I came on, was to talk about Carly Rae Jepsen a bunch.
Perfect.
You've come to the right place. Ify, what's good?
Yeah. Well, what's good with me is I got two things. Well, one I'll save for later, and you'll know when it comes up. But I'm going to shout out the Dr. Pepper Strawberries and Cream Zero Sugar Soda. As you know, as I'm slimming down, getting cut, getting shredded up, right there, you know, I've also, you know, the trick, here's, everyone's like, oh, what's your trick? It's like eating whatever the fuck you want and then just lifting past it, but also finding ways to taste sweet things while having empty calories that don't add to your daily caloric count. But yeah, no, Dr. Pepper has, first they had the Dr. Pepper and cream soda, which was a smash hit. And now the scientists went to their own soda Los Alamos and started cooking up crazy strawberry things. Yes, and there's strawberries and cream Dr. Pepper, which tastes like strawberry milkshake soda.
All right, I'm literally writing this
highly
down.
Recommend. Yeah, if you are a zero head, this is because, you know, I know some people are like, I don't like I want the regular, I want all the high fructose corn syrup. And it sounds like I'm being patronizing. High fructose corn syrup, enjoy it. I am not one of those weird health people who's like, I will never let sugar enter my body. I will let sugar enter me in ways that I can't say on this podcast, where it'll be canceled. But yeah, no, all about the Dr. Pepper, strawberries and cream, zero sugar.
I don't trust when diet soda people tell me that something is sweet. It's like when a vegan tells you, oh, it's just like bacon. And you're like, when's the last time you had bacon a point of comparison? Like,
well, zero is so funny because the whole reason they had to, this is if you've listened to the pod, you've heard me say this fun fact, but Tom, maybe this will be your first time. Reason Coke Zero exists is because Diet Coke doesn't taste like Coke, because it is new Coke. It's the new Coke formula in Diet Coke form. So real quick, I'm going to try to do this very truncated so that this doesn't get cut out.
There's so much science in this episode.
You remember when they did new Coke, everyone hated it, and then they went back? Mm-hmm. Well, the sales for Diet Coke were actually good. So when they went to Coca-Cola Classic and went back to the original formula, they didn't do the same thing for Diet Coke. That's why Diet Coke tastes different than New Coke. So then they made Coke Zero so that they actually have a diet version of Coca-Cola Classic.
Iffy, this is great. Could you have one half of this explanation in black and white and label it Fusion and one half in Fusion? Just so I can, because you're jumping back and forth with New Coke.
We have to be jumping between timelines, right? Yeah. We have to go to now. This is the podcast and it's in color. And then it goes back in time when the scientists at Coke
Robert Downey Jr. Is pitching New Coke. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we're ready.
I want you to know, I resent this tangent because I had a whole sugar, I hardly know her, locked and loaded. Oh. And then you went on this thing and there goes my sweet ass joke.
Well, let's keep them locked and loaded, okay? And then we'll drop them in the middle of the desert because we're finally completing our Barbenheimer review experience by talking about Oppenheimer. Woo! Then we'll pitch some scientific discovery movies of our own invention, so to speak. But first, it's time for Itadick, our movie news segment, where we ask the question, is this important? Do I care? With this week's movie news. To kick things off, an AI program imagined Barbies from around the world, and wouldn't you know, it turned out super racist. BuzzFeed published an article where they used an AI program to imagine what Barbies would look like around the world. The AI program generated Barbies that drew on racist and xenophobic stereotypes based on the country of origin. For example, the South Sudanese Barbie featured a gun as her accessory. Sudan is currently fighting a war between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces right now. Is this important? Do you care?
Well, I think this goes back to an old expression in the computer world, which is G-I-G-O, garbage in, garbage out. And if AI is basically going to, you know, graze on what's on the internet and kind of, you know, borrow from other people's ideas, then they're going to wind up borrowing a lot of crap and a lot of nonsense that is out there in the world. And so, yeah. This is what happens when you don't have like an actual human being at the controls.
Yeah. I'll even go furthermore to go to an inner deep dive in how funny of a fuck up this is. This is coming from BuzzFeed, who published it, very recently, Jonah Peretti, their CEO, is all in on AI and said that they were slowly going to replace their articles, actual human writers, with AI. So to see a fuck up like this happen so royally from them is very funny to me, especially as an ex-employee there. It makes, you know, the schadenfreude go really great, because a lot of great, you know, friends are losing their jobs. And a lot of the humans that put BuzzFeed on the map, you know, BuzzFeed News specifically, are trying to be like replaced by AI. And it's like, yeah, cool. Fuck over the humans that put brought legitimacy to your like listicle site. And now they're just going back and forth. So that's what makes it even funny. But like, I think, you know, you put the nail right on the head, Alonzo. The ceiling to AI is that it's extremely derivative. And it, when there's all these, like, you know, tech bros with the hexagonal NFT avatars that are just like just praising AI, it is just such a limited scope and an underappreciation for art, which makes sense because that's why you'd get into NFTs. But, you know,
it's plagiarism software.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, yeah, it's extremely derivative, and you're not even trying to create a pool, because that would be too much legitimate work. You know, the reason you like AI is because you want to be lazy. So instead you're like, I'm gonna give you the whole internet. And it's like we've forgotten what's on the whole internet.
Absolute garbage monsters at every corner. No, it's such a good point, the idea of it being derivative, because there's either two ways you can take AI from where I'm seeing, especially in this kind of instance. One, it's taking and pooling from everywhere, and so it is negative and ugly, and then there's no common sense laid to, like, the stereotypes being put out, and also all of the things that it's lifting are presumably artists that aren't being credited, rewarded, acknowledged, or compensated. Or the other side of it is where, when the more AI trains itself on it, it's just so error ridden that it's like, what? You're making things up. You're making it up whole cloth. So
the Hollywood Reporter recently had that embarrassment with their little whoopsie, where they ran the piece about the films that got into Venice, and their AI thing collected some shitty comment from some dumb movie website bitching about Ava DuVernay, and they ran
a right wing one too.
So it's just like, oh, well played, everybody. This is going great.
Yeah. Perfect. Perfect model.
Indeed.
I think we would say. Yeah.
And speaking of things that need to be replaced wholesale, intellectual property, aka IP, now offers production companies and their top executives a quick way to turn profit in the age of streaming. Reboots and spinoffs of existing films and TV shows make it easy to create a continuous stream of income for Hollywood's top CEOs. For example, Barbie's box office success, with over $1 billion grossed worldwide, has now inspired Mattel's CEO to build their own cinematic universe based on the company's IP. In the works are a Polly Pocket movie directed by Lena Dunham, a Barney movie starring Daniel Kaluuya, and a Hot Wheels movie. While filmmaking appears to have succumbed to the demands of capitalism, the SAG-AFTRA and WGA strikes prove that there is still the time and the will to shift the tides in Hollywood. What's at stake is nothing less than the future of film and television. Will film and TV still be able to coexist as an honest creative outlet, or will the greed of production companies and their CEOs completely overhaul the industry? This is a valid question being asked by a really good piece at Teen Vogue. But for now, is this important? Do you care?
Yes, indeed. Let's kick this off. It's very important we care. I mean, you know, obligatory. Speaking of uncreative people trying to be creative, you know, I think the thing that sucks about the, you know, Marvelication, which I've been saying, of movies, is that everyone's trying so hard to make a cinematic universe. Well, shout out to the dark cinematic universe that Universal tried to do. I'm sure that's still coming. Like, it is
the various iterations of the DC.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, the reason the Marvel Cinematic Universe worked in the first place is because it made sense. It was copying what it's adapting, which is a bunch of comic books that come over for a crossover. And also, that's kind of what makes it good, is because it's like, it was sequels within reason. You're trying to tell an extended story. You knew that the source material was long enough. You don't need to create a Mattel cinematic universe, because I don't want to see Barbie meeting Polly Pocket meeting Tonka trucks. Like, we don't want to. if you want to see how well that works, go watch the new Space Jam. It doesn't. It's because it's forced. It's not natural. And if I'm being real honest, and listen up, execs, you're going to really hate the honest truth. If you really wanted to create the cinematic universe, you would need to hire a talented artist at the head to plan that out, and not just go, this movie was successful, let's do it. And to even bring it all the way back, That's how companies like BuzzFeed creates contents. They throw a bunch of videos at the wall, and the ones that are successful get sequels. And you know what sucks? Is it sucks for the creators who are trying to create series that they think will grow over time. Those get skipped because they're not allowed to grow. It has to be an instant success or not. And so what happens now with all this money that you invest, all these people you hire to write Barbie 2 to 5, and then Barbie 2 comes out, it's not a hit. Now three through five is canceled, and all those people who had work and jobs and canceled other roles for to make space for your cinematic universe, it gets skipped on because that's where we're heading. You're chasing the golden goose. I'm sure that isn't the analogy, but you're chasing it down, and you're trying to make follow the hits instead of making them. Like Hollywood, you're the hit maker. You don't do it. Now, what does this have to do with with the strike? Well, I think that it is it's how we got here, right? It's the thinking about the dollar and not the product. And I think that is just bad business, right? Like when you start to forget about what you're creating in pursuit of the dollar, in pursuit of numbers, that the goalpost is always moved. I think I mentioned one time where Blizzard said they made twice as much as they made the year before, but because they promised, I think they made $2 billion in a year, but because they promised $3 billion, it was looked at as a loss as a shareholder. I don't think you know how much $2 billion is to ever look at that as a loss, because for that amount of money, you can quite literally end world hunger. But because we are trying to fill the pockets of the rich, everything down to the common man, to the day-to-day worker, they're trying to figure out a way to etch us out. And that's why we're striking. And I think that we are seeing this not only in Hollywood, like we said last time, UPS, and now we have the VFX union and Marvel, who are, speaking of Marvel, they are heavily abused. I think many articles from what they deal with has been spoken about on this podcast, because they get these super quick turnarounds for the same thing that we're talking about. Wall Street is the problem, and every sector of the industry is really starting to feel it because it's not sustainable.
And to be clear, it's not like the film industry ever existed as a nonprofit. I mean, yes, yeah, from the dawn of its existence, it's been about making money. But the difference is you had a couple of generations of moguls who genuinely gave at least a little bit of a shit about art or about entertainment, even about just sort of like, you know, creating these films that would ideally pay off with audiences. But, you know, they were slapping their name on them, and they wanted to be proud of them. And I think also in these eras, you would get a wider variety of movies at a wider variety of budgets in the hopes that something was going to take off, as opposed to nowadays, where it's all about putting all the eggs in a very few number of baskets. And if they don't take off, then, you know, too bad, you're screwed. And then you have this new generation of, you know, like investment, you know, management funding, you know, Wall Street jokers who see these venerable studios as being things to be, you know, stripped apart like anything else, any other company that they acquire, and sell off, you know, the pieces, you know, to make some money for the stockholders. If they thought that the 35 millimeter print library of Paramount or Sony or any of these companies, you know, would be more profitable to like break them up and turn them into guitar picks, they would do it in a hot second. Like, they don't care about any of this. And again, I'm not trying to pretend like there was ever this era where they didn't care about money, but there was a time where you could care about money and also want to put out a quality product. And now the product is the last consideration for these folks.
There's like a resentment that they actually have to be making things too. I do like in that article that there's a whole thing about how David Zaslav, who's really made a name for himself as a king asshole for a lot of this,
as the villain of this era.
Exactly. But that, like, he rose to prominence within Warner Brothers Discovery as the guy who put all of his eggs in the Duggar basket.
Exactly.
And
that worked out well.
We saw the court cases that came after that. So good for that guy. I'd also add, Our beloved Ingu King has a fantastic related article in The New Yorker called Hollywood Slow-Mo Self-Sabotage, which I encourage people to check out, that kind of digs into the shooting in the foot scenario. Speaking of bummers related to movies, Multiple nonprofit organizations and charities in Los Angeles reveal there's been an uptick in demand for basic needs like food and housing as a result of the SAG-AFTRA WGA strikes. The people most vulnerable to food and housing insecurity are early career employees that are often compensated with food at their jobs rather than wages. The Los Angeles Regional Food Bank has seen a 9% increase in their year-over-year distribution, attributing a meaningful portion directly to the strikes. The Entertainment Community Fund, a nonprofit that provides financial assistance to folks working in the entertainment industry, also saw an increased demand. Prior to the strikes, the ECF was working on about 50 grants per week. Now they're receiving about 50 applications per day for immediate help with basic living expenses for groceries. And again, that fund covers all crew, not just in the striking unions. Something to note is government assistance programs are not available to striking workers. They are not eligible for SNAP benefits or unemployment assistance, meaning these workers have no federal safety net and have to rely on nonprofits, private organizations for aid, although Senator John Fetterman is actually working on something to try and combat that. Is this important? Do you care?
Extremely, yes. What's been driving me nuts of late is how so much of the, you know, media companies that are also happen to be, you know, arms of other companies that are you know, on the AMPTP side of all this, love to frame this as like, well, it's really sad that, you know, this cleaning company that, you know, cleans up sound stages, you know, the strikes are really keeping them from working, or the strikes are keeping the publicists from working, or these caterers, or these florists, or these da da da. And it's like, yes, all of these people are not working and all these people need to be helped out, but it is not SAG and the Writers Guild's fault. It is the AMPTP's fault for not going to the table, for not willing, being willing to make, you know, a reasonable demands met for these folks. And so, yeah, that's why, you know, when nothing is shooting, we're seeing this ripple effect that's going out. Because like Dre said, the DGA isn't striking, but DGA members aren't working. And a lot of those people are maybe fresh out of the trainee program, or, you know, or second ADs who don't necessarily have like a nest egg put away for this kind of stuff. So yeah,
a lot of IOTSI.
Absolutely.
All
of these different facets of the entertainment community. So, you know, it has always been helpful, especially I think since the beginning of COVID, for people to be, if they can afford it, to support food banks, to support mutual aid organizations. But here in Los Angeles, especially now, so many people are out of work because of the greed of these companies that are letting these strikes happen, that they absolutely need the help if you can swing it.
And shout out to one of the few strike-related news stories that didn't bum me the hell out, which was all those like mega stars like George Clooney, mm-hmm, and Dwayne The Rock Johnson, all these people who are like Seth MacFarlane gave like over $1 million himself. Anyway, they are now anteing up. And good for them, rich people. Yes. That is what you should be doing.
Whatever you gave Oprah, yes, thank you, but you could probably do more.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, it's Oppie time.
You there. Have you considered listening to the Beef and Dairy Network, an award-winning comedy show in the form of a newsletter podcast for the beef and dairy industries? Well, maybe you should. And why don't you try our most recent episode, episode 99, which features American man Paul F. Tompkins playing Queen Elizabeth II's former personal beef sommelier.
Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II and I laying on the floor of her bedroom, helplessly laughing till tears run down our faces as corgis are jumping on us, over us, licking us. That is a day that I will treasure forever until I am executed.
Find the show at MaximumFun.org.
I hope there's beef in heaven. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ivy Wadiway. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Tom Lum,
Alonzo Duraldi.
A 3-hour adaptation of a 700-page biography about a physicist doesn't sound like the DNA of a summer blockbuster, but in the annals of world history, this isn't just any physicist. Add director Christopher Nolan into the equation, along with the good fortune of becoming half of 21st century cinema biggest double feature, and you've got something explosive. So Drea, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Oppenheimer?
Yeah, a brief synopsis of this 3-hour motion picture. Sure. All right. So We are on two tracks in this story because it's Christopher Nolan. So there's also, of course, many timelines. But basically, we are pivoting around physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, who is brought on to oversee the Manhattan Project during World War II, spending years putting together a team, building a town in the middle of New Mexico to develop and design the atomic bomb. We are also seeing later in his career when he is going through a sort of courtroom charade about security clearance that is questioning his loyalty, his allegiances, his potential communist ties, and very late developing remorse for indeed succeeding in designing the first atomic bomb. Yeah. Oppenheimer. Oh, there's also like two women. Oppenheimer.
Yeah. It's Oppie time, as they
I
say.
I very nearly said no to hopping onto this because I was unsure how this was going to be handled. Obviously, it's a very like nuanced subject, and I was very worried it was going to be
Wasn't it great when we irradiated all those Japanese people?
Yeah. And I've this is again the foreshadowing to the end, but I've read Barefoot Again, which is a autobiography of a person who survived the bombings, and so in my mind I was like, oh boy, I don't know. But I will say I came out I was very surprised how nuanced it was into sort of both Oppenheimer himself and also the complicated situation in the U.S. and how kind of I'm surprised how like openly anti-American it was at many points. Which surprised me.
Yeah, I that's a good thing, and I think it is one of the things we should take a swing at first, because it is very, you know, I saw it very recently, and it's and the film Twitter discourse was always so funny, because I think that and I mean this like truly, how reductive I think film debate is on Twitter, because I think everyone doesn't take in a film when they come into their opinion. They're like, just on paper. So there was a lot of talk of like, you know, I don't think that it covers, you know, it covers the effect it has on the Japanese people that was enough. And, you know, I kind of went in with that lens in my head, and I was like, oh, I think Christopher Nolan did his best to highlight that. And I think it kind of helps with the fact of the way that his actions did both in the film and real life affect Oppenheimer. Like, I know it's like, you know, it's, you can be super reductive and be like, boo hoo, the guy who built this bomb feels bad about it. But I do think there was an argument to be made of being, and, you know, as a scientist yourself, Tom, being so caught up in the scientist as the great Jeff Goldblum once said, being so caught up of whether the fact you could and not thinking about whether or not you should. You know, because when you're really following it, you're seeing that they're kind of having this this breakthrough in physics that leads to this becoming a bomb. But like, you know, it all started with the idea of like how to transfer these neurons and firing them off each other and just this element. And I think, you know, then they even kind of doubled down and leaned into it by showing the scene where Oppenheimer is seeing the effects of the bomb on the Japanese people. And I was wondering, I was like, would people have felt better or worse if we saw those real life images? That is the thing.
I very much went into the film with that initial perspective of the like, on paper, this sounds bad. I literally wrote this down in my notes. You guys can see it here. It's a, if you want to read it, it says number of Japanese actors, and it is zero.
Japanese actors.
And yeah. At first I thought, but again, after having watched it, I almost felt like it almost would have been worse maybe for him to have like played puppets, like, right? It would have felt, yes, in my mind, maybe almost worse for him to reenact these grotesque things. And in many ways, I didn't know this. It was very chilling to learn that like Oppenheimer heard about this from the radio, from like everyone else, that like that his distance from it is almost part of the oddity of the whole thing, which I thought was very interesting. So Even though this remained untallied, I was very pleasantly surprised.
I have issues with the movie, and we can get into that. But I think
same.
But I think it's a little it's disingenuous to think that anybody in the year of our Lord 2023 is going to make a movie about Robert Oppenheimer and be neutral about the atomic bomb. I mean, like it is inevitable that they have to address to some extent or other the sort of moral quandary that he is in as a scientist, as you're saying, somebody who's making breakthroughs and making discoveries, and then how those breakthroughs and discoveries are then implemented by the military industrial complex. And for the issues that I have with this movie, yeah, that is not one of them.
I'll tip into the issues pile. I agree with both of you on the representation, and I do prefer the tact that he took rather than like, I was thinking of like, oh yeah, I'll bring up Justice League. Like, oh, let's just show that one family. Like, that's gonna like it would seem so disingenuous. And I'd rather it this way. It's called Oppenheimer. Fine. For me, my issues, well before representation or anything, were, you know, it's a 3-hour film, and through everything, I have this caveat of I think it is like a technical marvel. I really love and find Nolan's directorial style so specific to him, and something that came across in this film to its detriment, I think, that has worked elsewhere, is the entire first hour of this, he does not really do scenes. It's the whole thing of it is this like pacing, and it's like you're like growing it and you're moving, but you are just getting snippets of scenes for an entire hour that started to feel like a Wikipedia. Like, and then he had this moment here, and then he met this person, then another person, and and like the craftsmanship,
like
exactly, it was like an hour long trailer, and like it's so hard because there's so much beautiful craft happening with sound design, with even performance moments within those. But for me, it was really hard to latch on. Like Jean Tatlock, the Florence Pugh character, is a fascinating subject in history. This is a woman who was like, I have no idea what sort of mental health issues she had, but they were major. And she also was like so young, very politically active, very like had all of these like interesting. And because of the feel that sort of trailerism, I'm like, oh, the entire Jean Tatlock thread gone. I kept being like, oh, I can't wait till they get to those scenes. That's going to be it's going to be amazing when we finally just pause and have a whole part of this movie. But no, da 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 da. So I had that, and then the middle half. Yep, there's three halves to this, you guys.
Like three halves.
Yeah, I'm here for my mathematic prowess. Yeah. Much like Oppenheimer, math is not my forte. But the first half I was getting this Wikipedia. The middle half is like, ooh, if the dramatic tension is, are these guys going to make this bomb? Like, I mean, I'm not a terrific student of history. I did know the answer to that one. The final third was the part I thought was most interesting because there's kind of a twist. It's when, you know, the two sort of weaving timelines come together and you're like, oh, there's an interesting component here. And that was so much more, like, I was so much more drawn in. Anyway, I had a much more complicated film reading of this than I expected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the moment I kind of caught the non-linear timeline, I was like, yep, here you go, Nolan. you love it. It will kill you to make a movie with a linear timeline. You got to do your thing. But I think it played well in the, I think, surprise of the third piece. I didn't quite get bumped as much on the first part, mostly because it felt like a heist movie. I was like, oh, this is like Nolan turning this into a heist movie. I will, you know, do the stance of being like, Nolan, you are regarded as probably one of the best writer directors of our time. You got to learn how to weave in women in a way that doesn't make them feel like props, because by the time we got, because, you know, I didn't do the research until after, I was like, I'm going to go in blind, I'm going to see this. But, you know, even though the stuff that happened with, I forget her name, it is
Tatlock.
Yeah. That is what happened in real life, but it really just feels like, oh, you just feel like a device to show guilt within Oppenheimer, because like we see you impress his book collection.
Can we talk about this scene?
Oh, please.
I feel like I'm losing my mind. I don't know how not everyone on Twitter is. This is the first thing I told my friends once I finished the film and to the friends who weren't going to watch it.
Oh, yeah. No, that's I said we have reached peak male fantasy when you have a baddie impressed by your book collection and goes to ride
and
your dick
the
and
line.
Then gives you your hottest bar. That, yeah, that gives you your catchphrase.
I was like, oh, that was so good.
I went into this movie not knowing a ton about Oppenheimer, but I know that line. I know that he quotes the Bhagavad Gita. Did I expect he was going to quote that line when his dick was in Florence Pugh's hand? I did not. And I think as a choice, that is hilarious. No, yeah, no. And I couldn't believe that I was the only person in my theater going, oh, fighting back giggles. Like, how camp, that moment.
Oh, I audibly laughed and everyone looked at me like I was crazy. I was like, this is because, and someone on Twitter pointed it out, because by doing it that way, that means that he watched that atom bomb, he thought about the baddie he fumbled.
Now that's good, actually.
Damn, I should have wiped her up. Damn.
You know who else blew me away?
Damn.
You know the other thing in my life that took me a long time to develop guilt for, and not while I was actively doing it. That component of it, like, yes, there's a fascinating element there. Like you were saying, that idea of like, oh, we were so concentrating on should we do it or could we do it. We didn't think about should we. I hate that because I'm like, oh, did you let a woman do the emotional labor then instead? Like, I find that as like, oh, yeah. I'm not, that don't impress me much. Like that idea of like, oh, I didn't clock into the moral reasoning of this or whatever. And it is beautifully, again, I feel like I'm kind of interested in reading American Prometheus because I think that there's a deep, interesting fictional thing in this. But in a cinematic way, although the cinema of it's beautiful, story-wise, I was like, oh, come on, you asshats. Like, the idea of all of these people doing all of this and that, like, literally, we watch the bombs go away on, like, the back of a Ford F-150. And then that's when the guys are like, oh, you think they're going to use those? Like, I just was like,
oh,
what are these idiots thinking about ever? Like, and why is that allowed? And I do think that's what I was trying to babble, that I think it's thread through nicely his idea of he's equally morally ambiguous to the concept of communism. Like, it's the same thing. He's like, oh, yeah, there's parts of this I get, and then I'm not going to interrogate it too much. You're never like, oh, that guy was a communist. You're like, no, that guy was absent-minded. Like, he wanted to help a few things. Yeah. So it's part of his character, but I'm also like, why is that allowed? Why men being men, you guys?
Have you guys ever seen Natalie Walker's videos on Twitter she used to do where she would pretend to be, like, the wife to a famous scientist?
Yes!
This was so tremendously that I highly recommend those. But one other thing that I thought, you know, I know this is, like, a very pessimistic read of me to do, but there's a moment where he's like wooing his second wife or his first wife,
Emily Blunt,
where he is both explaining like a scientific thing and like seducing her at the same time, like while he reaches for his hand. Yeah. It's like, ooh, it's like Adams. I know this is a pessimistic read, but like in my mind that tells me that explaining the science and the romance are both in Nolan's mind like 50%, and so you can do them at the same time because they're both equally like unimportant. So might as well like cram them both together. Yeah. Because like we don't have time in 3 hours.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny because I had a different kind of cynical thought there. And mine was, speaking of Barbenheimer, I just thought of the scene where they're all playing music to the Barbies, where I was like, oh, this is another male fantasy where it's like, let me explain science to you.
Are you watching The Godfather?
Yeah. The line to me that was nuts was that it was like, yeah, I'm a biologist, but physics escapes me. I was like, that's nuts. Like that, I was like, I'm not a scientist. I'm probably the furthest thing from like science smart guy. But I was like, it seems nuts to say that you're a biologist, but you have just no, like, physics is just so.
Oh, physics is such the big element. Boy.
And I will say, I will give credit for Nolan, it seems like he did try and fit in a lot of like what I've called in my head bad bitch moments, where like, you know, she really, like when she was like in his corner during the whole hearing and was like, yo, I would have spit in his face. I was like, oh, those are really cool like moments, and it really like was interesting. But then it left me wondering, what is the movie where we get to see this relationship even more fleshed out? Because that was probably the most I seen them communicate about a thing that wasn't either the bomb or cheating on their husband. And it is about protecting him, and it showed their camaraderie and their companionship. I think even the scene where she checks him for being sad, which is a nuts thing, being sad that his mistress committed suicide and is like, yo, we're out here. You got to make the bomb. Like things like that, I thought were really cool moments to not just have it be the sausage fest that it was. And but like in the end, like I said, top director, writer in the game right now, in some people's eyes, I would imagine you could weave that in a little bit.
What made me really crazy was like the whole movie, I'm thinking, okay, Emily Blunt is surely got something super on the horizon here. She would not have signed on for this. So we finally get to like her big Oscar clip moment in the hearing where she tells off the guy. And that's the moment when Nolan is like, you know what we need in here? More score, please. Let's really crank up that music, because a woman's talking and the audience is going to get fidgety.
Or else they'll be too bored.
Yeah.
I'm
like, is this really happening? You've got to be kidding me, because he knows by now that the rap is you don't know how to sound mix your movies, and that he would I almost expected like on a rolling cart the string section to come in behind Emily Blunt, preferably between Emily Blunt and the camera, you know, so that we wouldn't have to see her either, because we could barely hear her.
Yeah, I mean, but in that same note on the score, we know if he's a score nerd, and we know that this is scored by one of Iffy's favorite composers, Ludwig Göransson, coming all the way from Community straight to a Christopher
Whoa,
Nolan
did
movie.
Did I make that connection?
Yeah. So that's why, you know, and he used to help Donald Glover produce a lot of his Childish Gambino stuff. So that's why, like, it was like a perfect pairing for something like Black Panther. And if we just can dip, just stay awake to all the not music nerds in here, stay awake. But when he was doing the kind of like visualization.
The plink plonk moments?
Ludwig Göransson. Yeah. And all of the, when it was a bunch of like sparks and explosion, Ludwig Göransson did like, he like dipped into, he stepped away from like your contemporary and classical kind of scoring and leaned heavily into like an EDM sound that I think kind of implemented a vision of a future that I thought was very impressive on his end, and really like using like things like Moogs and synths that like I never expected to hear in a like, let's say Oscar Beatty movie, because that's definitely what, you know, Christopher's definitely going for that statue with this one.
The tempo changes and everything, I love that stuff during the suspenseful moments.
Yes, so just I just wanted to give my shout out to Ludwig. You snapped yet again. And Emily, and I do want to give that point, even though, you know, the sound was coming in too hard, when that was probably one of the baller moments in the movie, mostly because you kind of, it is paced in a way where you have to see him kind of take this lying down. At this point, we know that he's being fucked over. We're kind of like, and he's being fucked over for standing against what he did. And so now you're kind of a little bit more on the side of Oppenheimer, but you also are on Kitty's side, where it's like, why are you just taking this? And then you get to see her kind of tear down this smug lawyer guy. I was like, yeah, you know, if he's going to pull it out again, that's going to be one of them monologues in your acting classes. Buckle up. You're going to have to sit through five of those. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I do think Emily Blunt did great work with what was given to her, as same with Florence Pugh. And there was Jason Clarke has just really demonstrated the capacity to have a truly punchable face. So good for him to just like let them weaponize that to the best of their abilities. I definitely enjoyed where it ended up. I wish that dramatic tension I felt towards the end, and the like, oh, the Robert Downey Jr. of it, who's fantastic. Like the cast beautiful work throughout. Yeah. Like everyone's doing some really exciting stuff. Bet we are our buddy Benny Safdie, who we recently talked about in Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret. Yeah. And I was like, oh man, did Rachel McAdams make a fool out of him in that? He did great in this.
So good.
He's a great stone cold weirdo. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, brooding, sad, mean scientist. But I just, we're getting, we're getting along here. So I just want to run in and drop some of these, like we knew we were going to see Cillian Murphy. We knew, but there was like, I wasn't ready to see Rami Malek, Robert Downey Jr., Jack Quaid, Matt Damon, Josh Peck, Drake. I almost yelled, Drake and Josh is in this? Josh Hartnett.
Minnesota's own Josh Hartnett. Thank you very much.
I'm a fan of character actors, and I thought this was too much. Because like every time a new movie, a new scene started, I was like, oh, is that David Krumholtz? It was like this kind is that James Urbaniak? It's like I love
it. Was getting Wes Anderson.
I love all these actors, but it became this game of Where's Waldo, and it was like it was taking me out of the movie perpetually. Yeah.
Well, look, for me, it felt like I was at a great wedding because they were bringing out their best ones. you won't see a person of color, but you will see a lot of white people, and they went through.
I'm going to give my quick 2-minute rant of why this movie bugs the shit out of me.
Hell yeah!
First of all, for all of Nolan's reputation as being this technical craftsman masterwork, blah blah blah, there are shot counter shot of conversations in this movie that don't match, where the words don't match the mouths, and the shots don't match each other, that are very sloppy and kind of weirdly thrown together. The movie is too long and tries to throw its arms around too much. I agree with Iffy. If you had made this movie a heist picture about the Manhattan Project, I think you'd really have something. But I think there's so much at the beginning of Cillian Murphy staring at dust that just it's like, okay, we got it the first time, but no, he has to tell you 10 more times. And then at the end, when Robert Downey Jr. reveals his true colors, we have to reveal that another 10 times as well. Mm. Also, Nolan is a terrible writer of dialogue. So much of this movie just sounds these billboards running into each other, and they don't sound like how human beings speak, with the exception of Matt Damon and Alden Ehrenreich, oddly enough, with a total nothing role of just he's there to receive exposition dumps, and he's fascinating and much better, I think, than even Downey is, because his character is so one note. I think this movie is kind of up its own ass in a lot of the worst ways. And I know I'm in the minority. People love this movie and it's going to make all the money and win all the awards and, whatever. I'm at least now finally not the only mixed review on Metacritic. Thank you, Richard Brody of The New Yorker. I think there are great elements in here, but that overall it's too much and it's not enough.
Vote.
Ooh, yeah, vote on that great note. The way we vote for things on this pod is screen it being the highest, stream it being the next level, and skip it being self-explanatory. So
I'm
going to
say this it's a stream it, but if you're going to watch it at all, you should screen it, because it is a movie that benefits from the big booming IMAX sound and the whole eye-filling visual grandeur of it all, because there is visual grandeur, especially everything that's around the detonation of the atomic bomb. That is really stirring and unsettling, and all this, you will feel it in your bowels. So I'm a screen it, but I'm a stream it, but on the big screen.
That was my exact vote. I love that you said that, because like I said, I was just, to not mince words, straight bored for the first hour or so. I was clocking that's cool. Oh, that's nice.
Oh, good. But, another Brana accent.
Yeah. I was this is really kind of, what am I getting out of this that I couldn't have found through skimming an article? I do think it picks up, but I also was the same thing. Normally, this would just be a straight stream it for me, but I 100% agree with Alonso's phrasing. If you are going to see it, try and see it. It will be better that way. And also, if you see it bigger, then you can see how much sunscreen Benny Safdie puts on before they blow this up. And I want you to know, that's how much I wear every day. And that is why I'm a Dewey princess.
Oh, nothing but respect for my Joker.
Tom!
I might go skip it or screen it. I think, if you can see it in the fancy aspect ratio and in IMAX, but I think that's what I told my dad. And so I think I'm going to be honest to that.
Iffy.
It's me. You know me. I am a cishet male between the ages of 20 and 36. That is Christopher Nolan's target demo. So it was hitting for me. It's definitely a screener for me, but I definitely like, there are great concerns and I think great discussions to be had after watching a movie like this. Not on Twitter, do it in person. But like, yeah, there's like, I really do, as someone, like, I went through and I was sifting through the Oppenheimer lore, the real life Oppenheimer, and he does a good job of really kind of portraying this person. And it really, I think, the thing that rings true to me the most is the truth in that there really is a lead buried, which is the real chunk of the story, is how this person kind of gets fucked over by his own country after, you know, doing this because he had the audacity to have morals. I think the Truman conversation is very good, and the kind of being like, how dare you when I did it, even though he was just, anyway, yes, that is my rating. And with that, we're going to take a break, but we'll be right back after you hear from another show, Maximum Fun.
Hey there, beautiful people. I'm Jarrett Hill.
And I'm Trayvell Anderson. And we want to know, have you ever had mixed feelings about the things that you love?
Ooh, maybe about the things that you hate?
Then Fanti is the show for you. Fanti is the podcast for all those complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives.
You might have conflicting feelings about Kamala Harris or propaganda or interracial friending.
That's all right, because we do too. And we get into it every single Thursday. Catch this Slayworthy audio at MaximumFun.org. That's MaximumFun.org/Fanti. That's Fanti. Come get all this good good.
Or this great great.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ivy Wadiway. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duralde,
Tom Lum,
Treya Clark.
And today's movie centers around one of the most significant and terrifying scientific discoveries in history. And that makes it a movie with a lot of science talk in it. What scientific discovery, significant, terrifying, or none of the above, would you like to see or make a movie about?
If I may. May I?
Oh, of course.
Just to bridge off of what we're talking. You know, we just watched a historical film, and like so many historical films, women and people of color were not really present or doing anything of note, except for they were. And so what I would like to do something on is that, you know, throughout Oppenheimer, there's this thing of the, oh, we have to get this much uranium and this much whatever. That uranium was produced by the Calutron girls. There were like a ton of young women, most of them only had high school educations, who were all part of the Manhattan Project. They outpaced all of their male counterparts in creating this uranium. And it's kind of a fascinating idea, just like rows of women in front of these huge machines crafting this thing in this male-dominated world, possibly having thoughts about the morality of it even before it actually, you know, erupts. So I would love to see something about that. How did they put these women together? Like, it's a sort of hidden figures angle on it. Anyway, good for you, Calutron girls. And I'm sorry that your job title included the word girls.
Well, I think that's a banger title for the movie. Good for you, Calutron girls.
And there were like 10,000 of them, by the way.
Holy
moly. It wasn't
moly.
Just like... Yeah, it was
Think
so
of all the
many
character
of
actors we could get.
Who we got? Cherry Jones, not a girl. Who can we get?
Margot Martindale and Anne Dowd.
Yeah.
The sky's the limit. I had an idea, but it would have to be produced by the Nickelodeon Films division of Paramount. And that would be about the invention of slime. Which before the runnier version that is used during the Nickelodeon Kids Choice Awards, and of course before that on the classic television series, You Can't Do That on Television, season one of which, by the way, currently streaming on Paramount Plus. The toy from Mattel was introduced in 1976, so I was nine and thus the perfect age for it. And it is this cold, gloppy green thing they would sell you in a garbage can, a little plastic garbage can. And sometimes there were worms in it or eyeballs or whatever. And it's mostly made from guar gum. But there were, you know, various types over the years, you know, the whether you were playing some sort of like Ghostbusters thing or Ninja Turtles thing, they would sort of change the colors or the stuff. But it's polysaccharide guar gum and sodium tretaborate, and somebody had to invent that, and I'm sure there's a story there, and I would like to hear it.
Sodium propabrinate, I love it. Ooh. Sodium propabrinate, I hardly know her.
I'm stuck on guar gum.
Guar. Yeah, not that guar, unfortunately, yeah, but yeah, I would totally chew guar gum.
Tom.
Y'all, first of all, I gotta say, I cannot make a movie, but I can certainly research a podcast about some of these topics. These are genuinely super interesting. And all of, when I found out this question, I obviously was reaching all over the place for stuff.
But where I think do I one begin?
We did a podcast topic once on the history of recorded sound and that science. And I think it's just very interesting. There's one weird story that I do know of, which is that Alexander Graham Bell, we all know the telephone guy, apparently was trying to work on a phonograph that could record audio. And he was talking to a guy and he was like, yeah, I want to like model it on the human ear. Makes perfect sense. And then this guy was like, well, why don't you just use a human ear? And then Alexander Graham Bell said, well, I don't know how to get one. And then this guy said, I'll get one for you. And then he did. Which is just absolutely bonkers. But aside from that weird thing,
he knows a guy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We all, yeah, we all need someone in our lives like that. But aside from that, I think recorded sound is just such an interesting and thing we take for granted. And it's such there's also one other very interesting aspect, which is that the first devices that we used to record sound, we couldn't play back. So they would make these like etchings, like a waveform, but you couldn't listen to them because they weren't designed to. And then within the last like 10, 20 years, we've developed technology to play the waveform back, which is out of this world. And so then I'm thinking like the future version can be in black and white and it can be called fusion. And then the background.
Still oh, that. Clever.
But
it'll never work, it's... Tom. If
you know mine, it would be about Alice Augusta Ball, who created the Ball method, an effective treatment for leprosy. And also, you know, her great grandfather was one of the first Black Americans to make use of the daguerreotype photography process. So, like, you know, chemicals is in the family. So it would be this family story about chemicals. And also, you know, she created this treatment of leprosy using like Chalmugra oil and seeds, and it seems like a very natural approach to science. And I think it could be this kind of like, you know, seeking this inner, you know, inner battle where you're like, you know, already a Black woman in the field of science, and then on top of that you're tapping into like your roots and looking into seeds and something that, you know, her classmates and, you know, a guy who looks like Biff who bullies her he keeps talking about,
he'll be played by Jason Clark,
has this but also just this kind of like, you know, this relationship, because, you know, there's the, you know, great story of leprosy in the Bible, and so you're getting these, you know, these interstitial time cuts of you know, her thinking about Jesus, you know, just different things. And then at the end, the title sequence says, Ball is Life.
Girl, you did not. You, look at you. Yeah, look at you. You're so proud.
Ball is Life. The Alice Augusta
if
Ball
he accepted
story.
That whole pitch from that.
I thought you were going to say something about her and her great-grandfather. You were going to call it D's Balls.
Girl, come on. You guys, we got to be better than this. Come on.
I was like, wow, what a wonderful, yeah, cool.
Baller, I hardly know her.
And fun fact, leprosy seems to be on the uptick in Florida.
Oh God! Mm. Of course,
more relevant than ever. Mm.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. There's going
to
be a lot of.
Can I do a small shout out just to have on people's radar of?
Of course.
If you are listening to this and you are a filmmaker or considering being a filmmaker and want to make a project about science, either stealing one of our glorious ideas or having one of your own. Two quick things. For years, for a few years, I produced the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation Film Summit, and the Sloan Foundation funds films about science or scientists at different levels. There's development grants, there's production grants, there's post-production grants. So look into that. And there's the Science and Entertainment Exchange, which is a program of the National Academy of Sciences. If you are writing something or developing something and it has a scientific element to it, they will connect you with a scientist or engineer in that field to either fact check or brief you on it and make sure you're using the science correctly. And I think that's wonderful. They're two fields that aren't always working in tandem. So just to put that out there, I think that's a very cool organization.
Nice.
I don't get any money from that.
But you should.
we'll see about that. I'll make some calls. Now it's time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. So who wants to start?
I'm going to dig back a bit. This movie that we're talking about this week made me think about the classic 1988 anime from Isao Takahata, Grave of the Fireflies. You thought this movie was a bummer about the atomic bomb. Good. Wait until you get this story about two orphan children doing their best to survive on the streets during World War II, and then the bomb drops. And the movie's not over. It's great, and it is one of the most devastating films I've ever seen, but so good that I nonetheless recommend it. It's gorgeous and haunting and, one of the essential films to be made about the era of the A-bomb, and it is available for rent from iTunes and Vudu.
And Vidiots.
Oh, well, sure. Yeah, I got that physical media.
I wholeheartedly back that up, Alonzo.
Thank you.
My movie has nothing to do with anything we've talked about today. So, but it is directed by a friend of the podcast and a previous guest of ours, Jared Moshe. He was on when we did The Harder They Fall. The two films that he directed prior to this were Westerns. And he has a new film out called Aporia, which is in theaters right now. It's doing a small release. So do keep an eye out for it digitally in the near future if you're not able to see it. It stars my girl Judy Greer. It is an incredible sort of ethical family melodrama with a sci-fi twist. She loses her husband in an accident, and then his friend has invented a time travel device, and it is much more in the kind of After Yang world of soft sci-fi, of exploring like the human elements of those scenarios. And I think it's kind of fantastic, and please go see it, support it. Jared's a good guy, but I genuinely think you will dig this movie.
All right, Jared, congrats.
Yeah. I don't want to go last because mine is also a bummer, like Alonzo's.
How about it?
Yeah, I'd recommend a film that hasn't such you think such a very like nuanced and firsthand depiction of the bomb droppings, which is The Wolverine. That was a joke. Just wild that that happened. God. We all remember when that happened? Anyway, no.
You just got a very quintessential, what I call the Minnesota meek smile, which is what you give people if you're stuck in a like elevator with them and you accidentally make eye contact.
No.
I mean, that movie is a bummer, so I believed you.
Like I mentioned, the film Barefoot Gen, and also the manga that it was adapted from is great. It's written by a person who as a child survived the Hiroshima bombings, and it is very, it's in some ways the polar opposite of Oppenheimer, because it is a firsthand account. It's an animated perspective. It is animated and about children. It's not for children. It is very grim, but it's very good. And I will also say, I first picked this book up a few years ago from a communist bookstore in Berkeley. So I think in many ways, Oppenheimer would have loved this.
Barefoot Gen is streaming for free with ads on the service Retro Crush.
Nice.
And you know, just to keep the, you know, the U.S. is bad theme going, the U.S. is bad paired with banger Emily Blunt performances. You know what I'm about to say? Yeah, we're talking about Sicario, baby. And he gets to see Benicio del Toro win, and Josh Brolin doing what he does. John Bernthal, Bernthal, and Jeffrey Donovan.
Let him keep going.
There's lots of bands. Yeah. Daniel Kaluuya.
Never mind. I was wrong.
But yeah, you could see, another dusty place that isn't the sand of Arrakis, directed by none other. Yeah, you know it. I did it.
You sure did that.
You did it.
Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah. 10 out of 10,
Yay,
Alonzo.
Thank
you so much to Tom Lum. Where can people find you?
You can find me on the internet. I'm Tom Lum Person. I make science videos, but also on the Max Fun Network. I make a show called Let's Learn Everything. It's a science and comedy show. We learn about science stuff like cosmic rays. We answer science questions like which animal has the most bones. But then we also end with a miscellaneous topic about something like Eurovision, fan fiction, pride flags. I will also pitch that, much like y'all's tagline, it is a science podcast that isn't just a bunch of straight white dudes.
Nice.
Wow. Good for you.
Yeah. Also, yeah, I didn't know how many science podcasts there were, but I'm pretty sure they probably had a bunch of straight white dudes. You know, I didn't even have to look it up.
Call
I
it
just
a hunch.
Know in my heart. Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. And you, listener, thank you for listening yet again. Follow us on our new Instagram account at Maximum Film Podcast. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/Maximum Film, or send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org. Hotline calls are welcome at MaximumFun.org/hotline. Our producer is Marissa Flaxbart. This week's show was also produced by Brianna Paz. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.